Welcome to the Told Me to Learn and Develop for Medical Educators podcast series from the Frank H. Netter MD School of Medicine. This podcast is for busy medical school faculty who want to expand their knowledge in teaching. I'm your host, Dr. Lisa Coplett, and I will bring you interviews with experts in medical education, fellow faculty, and medical students to discuss the issues most relevant to today's medical educators. Today, we're talking about flourishing as an academic faculty member. The Association of American Medical Colleges holds an annual conference entitled Learn, Serve, Lead. At the November 2023 conference in Seattle, I attended a workshop entitled Overcoming Challenges to Flourishing as an Academic Leader. The workshop was in one of the larger rooms of the convention center, and the room was absolutely packed, standing room only, which speaks to the need for the topic to the medical education leaders who are attending the conference. Well, the session was fantastic. It labeled common challenges such as imposter phenomenon, introversion and extroversion, and self-compassion, and provided practical strategies for participants to manage those challenges for themselves and to help and mentor others. While the workshop was aimed at academic leaders, most everything we discussed is relevant for faculty, and I really wanted to bring this session back for my colleagues. So today, I am honored to welcome back the workshop leaders who are all nationally recognized leaders in medical education. In addition to having a powerhouse group today, this is also my largest group interview to date on the podcast, and I'm excited for what will be a really lively discussion. I'd like to start by introducing each of my guests. I'm going to start with Dr. Linda Love, who is the Director of Faculty Development and Associate Professor in Psychiatry at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. She's also an educational scholar and executive coach, and she co-directs UNMC's popular year-long interprofessional leadership development program. She recently received her institution's Inspirational Mentor of Educators Awards and is dedicated to helping people design their best future. Welcome, Linda. Dr. Sherita Strong is the Assistant Vice Chancellor for Inclusion at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. She's an Associate Professor and Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Department of Psychiatry and the Psychiatry Director for the Student-Run Free Clinic. Clinically, she provides care at the University Psychiatry Clinic and Charles Drew Health Center, a federally qualified health center. She serves as a mentor and leader at UNMC and nationally in all aspects of her career. Welcome, Sherita. Dr. Catherine or Cassie Ferguson is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Section of Emergency Medicine and co-director of the Medical College of Wisconsin Health Equity Scholars Program and director of the Health System Science Thread. She's passionate about improving well-being in academic medicine and as evidence is often referred to her colleagues as the Chief Feelings Officer. Welcome, Cassie. And last but not least is Dr. Deb Simpson, who is the Academic Affairs Education Director for Advocate Aurora Health, a not-for-profit healthcare system whose physicians provide education to medical students, residents, fellows, and the health professions. She is an adjunct clinical professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin and University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, deputy editor for the Journal of Graduate Medical Education, and nothing short of a famous rock star in the world of medical education. Welcome, Deb. So Deb, I'm going to get started with you and start with this first question. When I think about flourishing, the other words that come to my mind are thriving and vitality. There are lots of components that contribute to faculty vitality or flourishing. And I'd love to know what topics your team selected as the barriers to focus on and how you chose them.
On behalf of my colleagues and one of our other presenters who's not able to be here, Dr. Karen Marcdante, who helped pull the session really together and kept us all honest and moving along. The term flourishing, I agree. I think, Lisa, that it too, I think about vitality and thriving and energy. And it's really a wholeness. It refers to three things: being and doing, realizing one's potential, which is why most of us are involved in faculty development, and helping others do the same, helping them be who they are, do the things that are important, realize their potential. But if we think about it as character strengths, you know, those things that we all take those little tests about and wonder who we are, it has to do with what your purpose is and what relationships you have and how you're feeling and your emotions, your health, your engagement. That is all positive parts that go into this whole. So when we put the session together, we really were thinking about an array of things that we know from probably between all of us over 100 years of being involved in medical education. Things that detract from that feeling of wholeness and don't let faculty thrive and grow. So from there, we just kind of brainstormed and pulled together some things and said, what do we think would be most helpful to education leaders to focus on? And so some of them you've heard about before, like self-compassion, that's Cassie's area of expertise, or imposter syndrome, which Linda and Sharita did, or introversion and extroversion, which is one that came to me as a problem in my daily work. All of these, though, and there are more, that limit our ability as faculty and learners to thrive at work. And isn't that what we as faculty want, is our students and our residents and our colleagues to be the best, to be amazing and happy? So that's kind of how it came together. At least that's the story I'm going to tell. I don't know if my colleagues have a different one.
One topic that we did not say that we were going to use was AI, right? We did not talk about writing an algorithm somewhere to put in some sort of operating system. That's not the proposition that we're talking about in helping humans flourish. That might be something different when we're talking about robots, but not humans. And so I think supporting the humans is an essential work. And we had some practical tips. It's not just important work, it's essential work to take care of the humans. And that's what we really focused on.
I think the overarching approach was, you know, we tend as faculty to be approached by administration and leadership around well-being as sort of the approach is typically, how do we remove the negative states of being? How do we take away, you know, the difficulties as opposed to how do we increase the positive states? How do we build on our strengths? And as Deb referred to, our character strengths in particular. And this idea that flourishing to me is, it's the opportunity to express and develop those strengths that then bring benefit not only to ourselves, but to our patients and to society at large. And when we're given that opportunity to build on those strengths and that opportunity to develop them, I think that that life leads to benefits for us, and it leads to benefits for the people that we care for, which is what, you know, we're about.
And so I'll just add, when we're talking about flourishing, we have to keep in mind some of the external factors versus the internal factors. And I think those are some of the things that Dr. Linda Love and I talked about, some of the imposter syndrome. Some of those things are more internal, but there's so many things, as we know, at our institutions, in our environment, that are external that we also have to manage.
So I felt when I went to this session, I mean, I was already sort of converted into this mindset before getting there. And it was interesting that, you know, people have been asking me my whole career, all the students, residents, faculty, you know, what is faculty development? And I've always answered that faculty development is any sort of professional development that helps faculty to thrive. And that was always what it was always very hard to encapsulate. So I really like the way that you're all defining it. That really spoke to me. And I loved this concept of helping the human. That was really wonderful. I wonder if we could get into some of the topics that you talked about and some of the barriers to the flourishing and sort of start to address each one. Let's start with maybe the concepts of introversion and extroversion. What do these traits mean in practice? And how do you know when your trait or your tendency is not helping you at work?
Well, this is the area that I spent some time on. And let me give you a little background. I had one of our residency program directors call me and say, "Do you know anything about if introverts get lower grades than extroverts?" I had never been asked that. We were on a Zoomy kind of call, and a couple people spoke up. "Well, I'm sure they do, because there are a lot of big mouths, quote unquote, in medicine, and they get all the airtime, and the introverts need a little more time to pull their thoughts together, to think through. Think about what we assess students and residents on: communication skills, you know, teamwork, contributions to the team. If you're an introvert, you kind of stand back. When we do some sessions on this, and Lisa, when you were at the session, we had the room, one, if you were an introvert, self-perceived, self-judged, sit on one side, and an extrovert on the other. The extrovert side, you couldn't hear yourself think on the introvert side because they're so noisy. It always happens. And the reality is, though, about a third to a half of our population in general are introverts. But as a society, we seem to value, and in medicine, we value it because some of those skills are important ones. Speaking up, you know, for patient safety, sharing ideas, making sure that you've got your input because you may have valid things about a patient that you talk to, versus an introvert kind of will sit back till they've put it all together in a story. And they won't blurt things out quickly. They wait till it's a little more formed. So it makes it tough. So in digging around in some of the data, there's been some work in the medical student field, which is really about, not a surprise, they get lower clerkship grades, particularly in their third year rotations. They have more stress and burnout because it's a harder environment when you're supposed to be on. And they need a little more quiet time. There isn't as much data in GME. There's some work on surgery. But it's an interesting concept because most everyone has a feel for whether they are an introvert or an extrovert. You know, and it's the one, you know, if you ever took one of those tests, would you rather go to a party with people you don't know or sit at home with your dog and read a good book? And when I took that, I was like, is that even a question? Are there, you know, how does that work? So I think it's one that we in medicine haven't thought about much. And we don't think about leaders, our education leaders, as being introverts or extroverts. And we need, which is a good thing, we need to think about what are the skills those people need. So they need to be able to listen, to pull, and our teachers, to listen, to pull ideas, to involve others, to create an inclusive environment, be able to challenge. Those are all areas that introverts can kind of thrive in. There's a great article that just came out in 2023, just as we were doing the session, by Marco Cohen. It's in Medical Teacher. It's one of their 12 tips ones. And it's 12 tips about how to be successful as an introvert, basically, in medical education. So that might be something people would be interested in.
What I really took away that I thought was so helpful for this session, for each piece of it, was that practical piece, right? What can we do? And so I loved that concept. And there's a lot of different ways to do it, but the bigger idea is to provide space for people to think, because not everybody is going to blurt out their ideas, you know, in the moment. And yet what you might learn, or the input you might get, or the perspective you might get from a colleague or a learner, could be really valuable, just giving people a minute to think. And there are so many different ways to provide that space.
I think what was really interesting from the live session was what was on the hearts and the minds of the leaders that were in the room and maybe the future leaders. And they brought up an interesting companion question to what Deb already said, and that was, are introverted or extroverted leaders more successful, or are they more beloved? And that's an interesting question to wrestle with. So that might have more to do with ability to connect with humans, not necessarily the speed with which you connect with humans, but how you thoughtfully connect with humans. But I thought that was another really rich layer that added to the discussion when we were in the large group.
Can I also just go back to Deb for one sec? Thank you, Linda. I just wanted to, can you give us an easy definition of introvert and extrovert?
There are really more traits versus, you have to think of it on a continuum. Extroverts tend to be more vocal, social, outgoing. Introverts are less so. They prefer smaller groups and one-on-one. They need more time. If you ask them how they re-energize, it's usually not with a lot of other people versus extroverts. They get charged up by being in a group and that nourishes them. So there's that emotional, social piece. And then there's also a cognitive piece. They tend to be more reflective and more focused. Extroverts tend to think out loud about what's going on in their heads and share that. So there are a number of dimensions. I don't think it's hard to tell, though. Think about when you're in a committee meeting as a faculty or a team meeting on the wards. Who speaks up first? And we have the same trouble with learners and faculty that are historically marginalized. That's a culture thing, not necessarily an introvert-extrovert, but it might be intersectional. So one of the things I like to say, and we talked about, we don't want everyone to be introverts. What we really do is recognize what's the skills that we need to be successful in medicine and as teachers and faculty. And you need to communicate. You need to be willing to take some risks. And the things that help introverts do that is remind them of their purpose, of their values. So focusing on that will help them. As a teacher, use your strength, those listening skills, those synthesis skills, as I said before. And if you're an extrovert, they recommend that you become what they call graciously introvert literate, which usually means you try and put the pause button on for a while before you speak, because we often don't have that. And I think you'll find out on this podcast who's the introverts and who are the extroverts, by the way. We'll do a poll at the end. Does that help?
I won't say yes. No, that's really helpful. I just wanted to make sure we were all thinking about it in the same way.
Yeah. There are people we would be surprised at in our society who are self-declared introverts. And yet they have learned these skills and been highly successful, like Oprah Winfrey. So let's go back to what medicine is about, and the power of relationships, people, human connection, and sharing and collaboration. Sherita, what were you thinking?
Just a minor addition to, I believe, Lisa, you Deb, you started to say it's on this kind of on a spectrum. And I think it's also important to note it's not absolute, that in some settings, folks can be an extrovert or students can be an extrovert and can also be an introvert. And I think it just goes back to a lot of the things that Deb was just saying as far as how they show up in those spaces.
I think that's really helpful. And the other thing I think that's helpful is the fact that we're talking about this without judgment. There's no judgment, right, around which one's better, who's smarter, who's more successful. It's about these different traits serve you in different ways in different moments. And we want to have sort of gain clarity around ourselves, right, so that we can optimally function in different settings, but also about the people we work with and our learners so that we can help them. And I absolutely love the perspective from which you approached that. I would love to move on to the other topic that we're going to talk about, which is imposter syndrome. And Linda, I'm going to ask you to get us started with this. The imposter phenomenon or imposter syndrome has gotten a lot of attention, probably I feel like in the last 10 years or so. How would you describe what it means? And are there certain faculty who are more likely to experience this phenomenon?
Well, imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon, a lot of people use those two terms interchangeably, involves the feelings of self-doubt and incompetence that persist despite your education, despite your experiences, despite all of your accomplishments, the real evidence, right? They persist. And feeling like an imposter affects all humans, and it can happen any time in life. It's not just a certain age group or a certain experience level. But what does it feel like? Who might be experiencing or prone to imposter phenomenon? It might feel like if you feel the pressure that everything must be perfect, that's self-doubt can creep in when we don't meet our own really ridiculously high standards. Or if you feel like you should or must demonstrate the pinnacle of expertise at all times, your confidence can be dinged when you don't meet those unreachable expectations or those unreachable standards. Or if you feel like you should be naturally great at any task all the time, including being the master throughout the entirety of your career, and no matter what's coming at you, and with the speed of change that's happening all the time in academic medicine and the world, these things can be activated in our personal lives. They can be activated in our work lives. If you're a new mom, if you're a new teacher, if you're a new clinician, you're all of the gamut, right? There's lots in there. And you can see how prevalent are many opportunities that can emerge in academic medical centers, and many, many more, right? So high achievers are alive and well among us. That's kind of our workforce. But just because we have high achievers that outwardly radiate a sense of confidence doesn't mean that there isn't maybe some struggle underneath. And I think being mindful of the whole human is really an important piece. I know many of us, this podcast, I would probably suggest all of us have felt these kinds of feelings at some time in our career. But as Sherita said earlier, those are things that I hold within myself, but there is that additional layer of our external environment in academic medicine. And when we don't see people that look like us around us, we could be prone to these feelings of being a imposter. Do I fit in here? Do I belong here? Am I supposed to be here? Again, despite all the evidence that we know is true, that we do actually belong here.
Sherita, I'd love to ask you to help us think about, so let's say I feel like I'm experiencing imposter syndrome. What can I do to overcome it or to at least mitigate it? Just getting to the practical piece of this.
I would say the first thing is, you know, we've heard the phrase, name it to tame it. And I will say I was a brand new faculty member in around 2008, 2009 when I first heard this terminology. So we're talking about it all the time. We're talking about it with our faculty, our learners. But it was something that nobody talked to me about. And I just felt like the world was just opened up, like somebody understands me, understands my journey. So I would say that that's the first thing, is naming it to tame it, establishing its prevalence, and establishing and understanding what it means for an individual person. Again, that internal kind of component. And so the more that we are aware of it, then we can use the tips, you know, some of the things that we've talked about so far to be able to manage it.
I was thinking that when we were all preparing this, it was very interesting to hear people's own personal stories of when they felt like an imposter. And I think that's part of what happened at the session, is people got to make some of that public. And we need to reconcile, because our faculty and we are not going to thrive in our, by order, our learners, if who they are on the exterior side, as Sherita said, is not who they are on the inside. And we need to help with that, because gosh dang it, you all are amazing, but you don't feel that way.
Is that how you help with it? By pointing out people's accomplishments and abilities and being more explicit about it?
I think that's one of the solutions, absolutely. I mean, it lies in all of our stories. And I thought that was one of the coolest moments. I agree with Deb, in the live session. And I thought it brought the academic medicine community. Didn't make any difference if you were from Texas, Nebraska, Maine, where are you from? Their stories were what were interesting. Like, they were all feeling these same things. And so that sense of belonging, like, somebody gets me in academic medicine. that was a very unexpected outcome, I thought, that was just beautiful in the live session. And the more that we talk about it, that's what contributes to, hey, we all belong here. We all deserve to be here. And we all have something to offer. I think one of those skills of Sherita said is establishing that prevalence, that I'm feeling this and it is normal. It's not abnormal. It doesn't place you in the outside or the other kind of situation. I love that.
As I'm listening to all of you talking about this, one thing that came to my mind is it sounds like there may be a linkage between people who have more of a tendency towards imposter syndrome and people maybe with a more fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And I was wondering if you found that or if anybody wants to speak to that.
If you haven't read the book, if you're an introvert, if you think that you're an introvert and you haven't read the book, Quiet, that is such a fabulous read. And I've talked to so many people who, after they read that book, said, oh my gosh, that was life-changing because I'm recognized in this sphere. But just having a gateway to thinking differently about yourself, a growth mindset for sure, has been helpful for people that are professionals. They've been around for a while. They're not, you know, high schoolers.
Great. Cassie.
The thing that I've been most interested in is, you know, this literature around our personality traits and well-being and self-care and all of these tools that exist out in the world. What I'm most interested in is translating that to our profession, to medicine, because I think there is a significant amount of translating that needs to be done in order for these tools to be helpful, in order to think about these concepts in a way that connects with faculty and trainees and students. And I think one of the things that defines our profession is it is high stakes the entire way. And I think where, just as Linda pointed out, there will be multiple points in our career where imposter syndrome or that sense of not being enough or not belonging will flare up. And every time, I think it demands a different approach. And, you know, certainly in my life where I've felt the most vulnerable has been times I've made mistakes in clinical care. And when mistakes in clinical care happen, there's not much worse to sort of face as a physician, to know that you potentially harmed someone. And I think for faculty to understand that even in those moments, that there's the possibility of recovery and of restoration, that was particularly important to me in those moments. Like to ask ourselves in that question, what is it that I need right now and what's coming up for me? So just as Sherita said, we can name what it is and have our whole, you know, our amygdala stop firing and be able to be present and pick, you know, the next right thing.
And so I'll build on that. So we also have to navigate failure. We've all heard the story of Thomas Edison. How many light bulbs did he try to develop? 9,999. And if he had given up, then that would have been his story. But the 10,000th light bulb is what he ended up inventing. And I think with a growth mindset, going back to that question, with a growth mindset, then we recognize that failure is a part of our success.
I love that. It's so helpful. I feel like the whole concept of the growth mindset has really been long overdue as entering into medical education, because it frames so many things that we deal with, mistakes, imposter syndrome, all of these pieces. Linda.
I also a lot of times think that our growth happens so gradually over time without some reflection. We don't actually realize how far we've actually come on the spectrum. And so having some moments where we can clear some space, and maybe it's other people helping us to understand how far we've come. I know one of the most powerful moments for me in my career was having a reunion event for faculty after anybody that had completed one of our leadership development programs over 20 years came back and our reflective exercises were really quieting for the crowd, and we wanted them to be celebratory. But it was universal that people were thinking, I am hearkening back to the person who originally signed up for that leadership development program all those years ago. And I'm realizing I'm not even close to that same person anymore. Mm-hmm. But our change keeps happening kind of incrementally and slowly. Sometimes we don't realize. I think that helps with imposter phenomenon, bolster and quiet that imposter phenomenon if we can clear the space to recognize, wow, I am moving forward. I think that's a gift we give ourselves.
I love the concept of also trying to give others that gift, of being cognizant to do that when we think of it. Deb?
I think that's all part of a flourishing, Lisa, as you just described. Give back to others is part of flourishing, helping others grow and develop, which is what we all do as teachers. I was surprised after our session and during the rest of the AAMC, how many people came up and talked to me about the session. And I've done some other sessions at AAMC. But the challenge, I think, was some people went, I thought, beyond just imposter syndrome, and they were not doing well mental health wise. And when we talked about it, they just seemed alone and they had no colleagues or people they could share. And I think it goes to what Cassie talks about, which is the culture of medicine is to be tough. And when you fail, and Cassie, I know you've done some talks about failure, people are so relieved because the culture of medicine, you know, if I'm your patient, y'all, I don't want you making mistakes, but you are. That's what medicine is. So I don't know, Cassie, when does it tip from just being an imposter to not, you know, to stress and burnout and cascading down to other things that are adverse for physicians and clinicians?
You know, I think both imposter phenomenon and sort of the things on the other side of that scale interfere with our ability to do our jobs well. I think when those feelings begin to interfere with our abilities to engage with life outside of the hospital is when I start to think about that there's something else going on here. I talk very openly with medical students and frankly with other faculty as well about a specific mistake I made early on in my career. And what I noticed about that was not only was I having that feeling of sort of walking through the hallways and thinking that everybody was looking at me and thinking what a terrible physician I was, you know, whether they knew me or not, but I would also go home and I was, you know, I was sad a lot. I cried a lot. I was short with my family. I really retreated, you know, at work. I didn't want to see the sicker patients. I avoided going into rooms with patients who were more complex. And so when it starts to invade all of those aspects of your life, I feel like there's something more going on. And I imagine Shrita, as our resident psychiatrist, would have more to say about that.
I so appreciate, I just want to acknowledge and appreciate that specific and personal example, because I think that brings it to life. And I think most of us have been in that place in some capacity, certainly as a physician, and even if not as a physician, in some other way. So I thank you for that. I want to get Sharita's reaction or thoughts.
So thank you for saying that, Cassie. And again, thank you for being vulnerable, and your learners appreciate you for being vulnerable. I think just the way we grow up in medicine, this isn't a place where we can oftentimes be our true selves, our authentic selves. And how much better of a doctor are your students going to be after learning that they can also make mistakes, and that this awesome Dr. Ferguson, if she made a mistake, then when I make a mistake, it's going to be okay. I just wanted to, so of course, some of that can be related to an imposter syndrome, but as a psychiatrist, I think we also have to make sure that folks are delineating between imposter syndrome and maybe a diagnosable, treatable psychiatric condition that, you know, for instance, maybe a student has generalized anxiety that is not addressed, we're saying that this student maybe has imposter syndrome when maybe it's the anxiety disorder that's hindering them in some way. And so I think, you know, how do you have those kind of conversations with your learners? I want to just be mindful that we can't put everything in that imposter syndrome bucket and be aware of, we have a program at our institutions called Peers in Need of Support. And maybe a person comes out of that conversation that has imposter syndrome, but maybe there's some anxiety related. And this came out of the pandemic where we started providing just support for clinicians who were struggling with everything that was going on. And so we have psychiatrists, psychologists, and other folks that see these individuals on a one-on-one basis whenever they reach out. And it's called, like I said, PINS, Peers in Need of Support. And sometimes they just need someone to talk to and promote that positivity, encouragement, let them know that, you know, all the patients that they've lost on the ward, you know, it is just, it's not just them and just kind of a symptom of everything that's going on.
I feel like this conversation is moving us to the last topic very organically, which is self-compassion. And so, Cassie, I would love to come back to you and ask if we could start once again with a definition and also why it's just so important in medical education.
Absolutely. So self-compassion is very simply compassion turned inward. And what I learned early on in my exploration of self-compassion was that Dr. Kristen Neff, who's at the University of Texas at Austin, really learned about self-compassion and began exploring self-compassion because of her mindfulness practice. She had an established mindfulness practice and had read a lot about mindfulness as it sort of came out of Buddhism and other spiritual or religious traditions. And Pali is an ancient Indian language, actually, that a lot of the Buddhist texts are written in. And the word for compassion in Pali assumes compassion for others and compassion for self. There's not two different words. And somewhere along the line in the translation, in perhaps in Western culture, if we want to be general, we miss that. And we've separated them into two concepts. So the way that Dr. Neff, who's really done the bulk of research on self-compassion, has defined it more scientifically is that it consists of three different components. So it is a way of relating to yourself with warmth, with respect, with care. And that's the self-kindness piece. So that is, how would you speak to a friend who came to you with the same problem you're having or that you're dealing with? What would you say? What are the words that you would say? What would your body language be even? And rather than sort of harshly judging yourself for your flaws or your imagined flaws, you're offering yourself this unconditional acceptance and support. And the second component is what's called common humanity. And this is really just understanding that being human inherently involves failure. It inherently involves pain and imperfection and difficulty. And it's sort of getting out of our own head, right? There's feeling as if we're alone in our struggles. And it's really sort of understanding this interconnected experience or this interconnected perspective that we often lose, particularly early on in medical education, you know, because we're so focused on our grades and how we appear to other people that we forget that we are all interconnected. And the last one is this concept of mindfulness. And that's just really being able to see ourselves in a clear and balanced way, right? So when we hear that critical voice in our head, knowing that that's not the only story, that's just the story that we're telling ourselves in that moment. And if you can approach failure, difficulty, pain with those sort of perspectives, those lenses in place, there's a ton of research to show that it improves all sorts of facets of well-being. And in physicians in particular, one, they've showed that we can learn to be more self-compassionate, which is wonderful. And two, they've shown that those who are more self-compassionate are also at lower risk of burnout, lower risk of compassion fatigue, as they sometimes refer to it. So, you know, there's all sorts of benefits, and it's one of my most favorite things to talk about just because I've seen in my own life how it's changed my perspective.
I would love to share a quote that I'm completely stealing from your session because I wrote it down because it was so profound to me. And I looked up who it was from. It's from Pema Chodron. And I hope I'm doing her name justice. She's an American woman who became a Buddhist nun, and she wrote several books. And the quote was, "Compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity." And I thought that was just so profound. And so what can we do as leaders, as faculty, to nurture self-compassion in others and our working and learning environments, whether it's our learners or our team members, our mentees? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
That is one of my most favorite quotes. I use it frequently. I feel like it is one of the key things that students should learn, is that if we're not in touch with our own shortcomings, our own suffering, our own pain, we can't truly be present for the pain of other people in a way that makes them feel seen and understood, as opposed to feeling judged or looked at as separate. And I think where it starts is that we, as role models and people who are being looked at and watched by learners, we take back this idea of equanimity, which is, you know, Osler talked about many, many years ago as being this sort of stoicism and imperturbability and keeping our emotional life hidden from our patients, and really start to think about equanimity as like a balanced engagement with every aspect of being, you know, present for the suffering of other people and allowing ourselves to feel out loud and visibly and really embracing the vulnerability that that entails.
When I think about who I am truly attracted to in the professionals around me and probably in life, it is not the perfect person. It is the person, and I think the stories that go underneath those people, the failures underneath those people, the bumbling through life that happened, are what really adds to the fabric of them as a human. And that's what I'm truly, truly drawn to. And the more that I can relate my own stories and how I became whoever I am today, how with all of the warts, right? I think it's a gift also that comes back to me, because more people then are drawn to me. They're not, very few people are attracted to the perfect self, unless it's a Facebook profile or, you know, even Taylor Swift, as popular as she is, probably has some layers that we don't know everything about. But it's the really unique aspects. And I think that people become great when they put those pieces together, building on the failures and building on the bumbles and building on the things that they could have done better. I want to be that. I want to put that back into the world so that that just continues to grow. Not a bully entity that has to quiet or make people feel worse for being lesser than or different or failing in any capacity. I think it's a gift I give myself, and I think it's a gift I give back to the world and back, certainly back to academic medicine, where everybody is fabulous, right?
Any other last thoughts?
I'd like to close by trying to pull some of this together, because we've been jumping around a little bit. I have an introvert trait of trying to make sense of pieces that float and pull them together. Even if you all don't believe my story, I'll tell it anyway. Is, first of all, Lisa, I think we really want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to reunite, even though we're missing one of our compatriots. And I want to close with something she frequently talks about, which is the flourishing and thriving. And isn't that what we're all about? Making each other matter in the importance, and how easy it is if you can know a student's name and actually state it. It makes a difference. If you can disclose a little, not your whole life story, so that you have that human connection, which is one of the themes we've been talking about. But also the other underlying themes is we've been talking about purpose and meaning and how that all works and the connectivity of people. So I don't, as a non-physician, I don't know a more noble calling except one. For medicine than medicine. The more noble calling, I think, is for you all who are clinical teachers, clinical educators, and leaders, because what you're doing is that critical element of flourishing, which is generating the next generation and giving back and fulfilling and helping others achieve their best selves. So thank you.
Deb and Karen, who isn't with us, but I know she's listening, Linda, Sharita, and Cassie, thank you so much for bringing these topics to light. I will now never forget, you have to name it to tame it, Sharita, thank you, and for sharing your expertise with our listeners. This has been a really special episode today.
Thank you again for this opportunity, Lisa. This was a fabulous time.
I'm Lisa Coplett. Thanks for listening. I'd like to thank the people who contributed to this show, Katie Lyons, our producer, David DeRoche, our program director. For more information on other faculty development opportunities at Netter, email katie.lyons@qu.edu. For more information on all of Quinnipiac's podcasts, visit qu.edu/podcast. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram @QU Podcasts.